Today is Thursday, September 5th, 2019. This is a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Dixon Dick Hingson, H-I-N-G-S-O-N. My name is Tom Martin. This interview is being conducted at the kitchen table in our house here in Flagstaff, Arizona. Good afternoon, Dick. How are you today?
I'm doing very good. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you again for your willingness to talk about your connections to Grand Canyon. This is a part five interview, and at the end of part four, you had recounted your year in Zion and leaving Zion and going through another year of college and then off to Australia. When was the next time you were back at Grand Canyon?
Yeah, well, I got back to Grand Canyon in early 1970 during Easter week. And it was probably into March for a four-night backpack along the Hermit Trail to Tano Trail to, I think, Bright Angel Trail loop with a friend that I'd known from Harvard, fellow graduate student. His brother, his name was Bob Jean, and his brother Richard Jean in the same week was to be married to a Hopi girl out on the Second Mesa, and Hopi dances would conclude that week.
And Jean is spelled?
J-E-A-N-N-E. Okay. So it's Bob Jean that was my companion, but the brother was Richard Jean, who married a woman, Hopi woman named Laverne. I can't remember the last name, but anyway, that was Easter week. So that was a... by then, I'd learned how to do backpacking because I'd had the a 10-night backpack in the North Cascades 4 years earlier with a different Harvard graduate student, Ron Capon, and the whole thing there was up at the end of Lake Chelan.
Capon?
C-A-P-E-N.
Thank you.
Yeah. And that started at Lake Chelan at the north end of Lake Chelan and went up into the newly formed, you know, National Park, North Cascade. Hmm. So, I mean, that was, of course, the real eye-opener that this kind of rugged, self-sufficient backpacking could be done.
What kind of backpack did you have? Do you remember?
The Kelty.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Without him, I probably would never have been able to do more because I had to learn all that. So I came down having my eyes opened from that to the idea of this ought to happen at the Grand Canyon in connection with Bob Jean, and we went down to, we didn't go to the river.
Hang on a second, Dick. Yeah. I'm going to fill in some gaps here.
Oh, right, that's fine.
Just,
go ahead.
One of the questions I had as you were talking here is, had you read The Man Who Walked Through Time by Colin Fletcher by then?
No, I don't remember reading it. I can't remember having read it then.
Okay.
It came later,
okay.
But not then.
And did you graduate from Harvard?
I did graduate from Harvard, just to make it clear. That's right. That graduation was in at the end of 69. Well, actually, I finished the work at the end of 69 and moved cross-country to California by way of Flagstaff, actually, and arrived in Los Angeles in November of 1969 and started a postdoctoral fellowship at UCLA with Dr. Jared Diamond in the Department of Physiology.
What was your graduate degree in?
Anatomy.
And then, so how are you then tied in with Dr. Diamond? This is Jared Diamond, who writes amazingly well about books on the disasters that we as a species have done in certain areas, some sustainable, but a lot of unsustainable.
Easter Island
growth and development. Right. Yes,
that's right. That was the classic book. Came out much later, but the link had come because the connection with Diamond was that I had taken his course on membrane physiology as a graduate student at Harvard and done surprisingly well. I was identified to Diamond, who had two sides to him. He had the theoretical biophysics side, which had to do with membrane transport. And he had this other side that had to do with bird ecology in New Guinea, in which he was a world-renowned. So he had two sides to Dr. Diamond. But I didn't know that side. I just knew the membrane transport, and he took me on as his graduate student in UCLA, which triggered the move across country through Flagstaff to California. And then there I was, set up for this experience in early 1970 while doing that with another Harvard graduate student, Bob Jean. And then out of that came the idea of the Grand Canyon backpack and the wedding and so on.
So what can you tell me about Jared Diamond?
Diamond was... obviously, a brilliant man. He was a five-star sort of individual as a communicator and thinker. His courses were, he's a master teacher. He had come over from Harvard to UCLA, I think, with some special category of level of a salary and grade because of his genius. It's nothing short of that genius nature. And so he in spite of the fact that he crossed both of these things, he was in physiology. He was in the Department of Physiology at UCLA. I couldn't figure a way, though, to bridge to that part of him at that time. It was a little bit too. I wasn't enough into birds as he was. I'd been trained in anatomy and physiology, but his work at that time, he kept all of his membrane transport work going, and his own evolution continued later to where he actually left physiology and became a professor of geography in Southern California, but he that hadn't happened yet.
What was he like as a person?
He was a little bit of an odd one, as you might imagine. He was highly intellectual and brilliant, but he had to have had some problems here and there with some social circles because he was a little odd, brainy, sometimes a little imposing because of that.
Uh-huh.
I'm not certain I have a feeling some of his early social life must have been kind of difficult.
Hmm.
Just seeing this, I'd seen this before, the intellectual genius sort of person, but
mm-hmm.
that's going
mm-hmm.
to be recognized by the university.
Mm.
And
yeah.
So he gets to do all of that.
Okay. And what was your postdoc work on permeable barriers? That's still a big deal today as we look at wastewater out of municipal, where water is a real precious commodity, using permeable barriers to clean up water for reuse.
Well, that's right. You've got all kind of analogies about permeability, impermeability. This is still a very active field today,
mm-hmm.
with ion transport across cell membranes,
mm-hmm.
active transport. channels that are now being finally being able to be deciphered through the submicroscopic cell membrane. I mean, this is kind of frontier stuff, and so that's but it's at the far edge actually of my training as an electron microscopist, because at that time all you could see barely were the two parallel inside and the outside of the membranes, and they would stain, and it's only in took more decades before we got into the microtubules and other open shut. I mean, that field has advanced immeasurably since then, but remains very hot.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So the what got you interested in that first backpack up in the North Cascades?
That had to do with the friendship with Ron Capon, which had started while fellow graduate students over on the Cambridge side.
Okay.
So we had the friendship, and then he wanted a partner during that summer. I was at, I actually sort of truncated or somehow left a Woods Hole appointment to go on that backpack with him. And it was, you know, I mean, there was quite a draw towards both him and the idea of the backpack.
Mm-hmm.
And learning car camping too on the trip. So the car camping, it was important, because if you're going to a lot of places, you're going to wind up having to learn how to do that too. And be comfortable with it. And so it was, I would just say it was definitely the friendship pull was very strong, but also the idea of getting into the learning how to do backpacking. We wound up planning. He led it. I mean, he knew what to do.
Right.
So I had a guide.
Well, so for being out for 10 nights, that's a lot of food to carry.
Yes, it was hard getting up that first hill. That's right. That was hard work. But somehow we did get up there, and I was blown away. Just blown away by the wilderness. And that was the wilderness, yes. In a way that maybe exceeded what I had done at Grand Canyon. Yes. That was another planet up there.
Did it rain on you guys?
We did have one day where it rained.
Okay.
Unfortunately, maybe it was a stationary day. It was the one stationary day, and that was the one where we had the most rain. Okay. So we did have that experience at some lake. I remember that.
Okay.
Anyway, we there's not much more to say on that one, except it just set me up for how this was done, and that it could be done. And backpacking.
Yeah. And I'm trying to think about what things you might have carried with you on the Cascades backpack that you didn't need in Grand Canyon.
Mm-hmm. Well, you would have had to have more rain gear. I mean, probably.
Okay.
It was a summer trip in the Cascades, so in that way it was like Grand Canyon in the spring, I think. So it wasn't different, except for you did have to be prepared for wet weather. It wasn't freezing. There wasn't anything remarkable you wouldn't use in the canyon too.
Okay, and certainly the backpack was an external frame. I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Aluminum.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay. Correct. Lightweight, right. Aluminum.
Yep.
That's right.
For the Grand Canyon backpack, then, an Easter, down the Hermit and across the Tonto and up the Bright Angel. I think by 1969, you would have needed to get a permit for that backpack.
Yes, but I can't remember all the circumstances of getting it. It was, yes, we probably had the Park Service permit,
Did Bob get that then?
Let's see. Probably. It may have been gotten sort of on spur of the moment. I don't think we had the capacity problems at that point.
That's right. They would have asked, though, for your skills at the time. Had Bob had prior experience backpacking in Grand Canyon?
Elsewhere.
Okay.
I don't know that he'd had it in the Grand Canyon. I was the one who knew the Grand Canyon better.
Okay.
But this certainly was a different route, probably no question of that.
Oh, well, that would make sense. You had multiple rim to rims.
That's correct.
Multiple.
That's correct.
And so that would have gotten you that permit would have been easier to get with that.
Oh yeah. There wouldn't have been a question of competence for it for getting the permit. I just don't remember.
Right.
But it was now a completely other level. Of exposure, and with much more time on the Tonneau Plateau. In fact, it was almost all on the Tonneau Plateau. And what comes back to mind were the long ins and outs of all of those side canyons, those exotic formations, inside of each one. The silence at night was quite obvious, and I think Bob was particularly struck at it. I've learned that later, actually. Sometimes it doesn't sink in quite at first what you got going, and he had never been in there.
Huh.
But he wrote me only a couple months ago where that, unprovoked, that was one of the core dimensions of that experience, almost like a suffocating silence where you heard nothing all night long. In the darkness, so it was. Yes, that was. I don't know how much we talked about that, but it was. The Tonneau is the quietest zone of the canyon, so that was informing the experience. Yes.
1970. Was there signs of a lot of other people there? Was there an easy trail to follow? Did you have to do some route finding?
No, I think the trail, we did not have a lot of trouble with that trail. The weather, we were blessed by the weather. And so I think the Tonneau Trail was I just remember it as a very doable, except for the endless back and forth in and out of the canyons. That's what stood out.
Uh-huh.
And
did you see any burros at the time?
No, we didn't. I don't remember. It didn't stick in mind, the wild burros.
Okay. And did you run into any other people?
This is 50 years ago.
I know.
No one stands out. I'm sure we did. I can't believe we didn't. I think we did, but there's no memorable encounter that stands out with that.
Okay.
Right. No.
As you came around into the Bright Angel Bay, you would have passed the spur trail going off to Plateau Point.
That's correct.
Did you drop your packs and walk out there?
That's a good question, but I had done that, as I said, in the final 62 summer. And I can't remember how much time we had. We still had this other event coming in. We might have, but it doesn't stand out. I'm pretty sure we didn't do it at sunset like I had with that other one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one that stands out, was that sunset. But we might have done it.
Did you hike down to the river at Hermit or Monument Creek?
Not on that trip.
Okay.
No, we didn't go to the, not on that trip. It was to come, but not on that trip.
Okay. All right. And anything else about that hike that you remember?
No, just it. Not really. We got on well. Mm-hmm. No injuries, no frustrations. I had some in the Cascades with Ron over just fatigue and blisters and complaining. There were certain things that we had to work through, but I don't remember it with Bob, anything like that. And I don't remember any other interpersonal thing one way or another about the trip, but it concluded the way it was supposed to. So it's just a wonderful, wonderful exposure, which I then was able to carry on in some other trips later forward from there on the other side of the Bright Angel Trail.
Okay.
You know, so I knew that trail was there, and that was a jump off point then from Indian Garden to for a subsequent exploration.
Further, heading further east on
heading
the
towards the, yeah, to, well, yeah. Heading further east towards the Kaibab Trail.
Yeah.
And yeah. all of it's mm-hmm. there. So I have actually, over time, wound up hiking that entire stretch of the Tano Trail between Hermit and the South Kaibab.
On that Easter hike in 1970, did you hear any planes during the day?
Nothing that stuck out at the time. You know, there's no... I'm sure you had to have heard some here and there, but it would have been very few.
Okay.
And nothing stuck out at that time.
Hmm.
So it was absent from... It didn't trigger anything. And so it was obviously less than what was coming. And that's the answer.
Yeah, okay. And was that backpack instrumental to you in any way, or was it just the first of many hikes in the Grand Canyon?
Well, it was.
It wasn't the first, actually. Even
no, it really wasn't the first, but it I think it was instrumental in that it exposed me to the richness and magic of the Tano zone of the canyon, and in that way, it was very. Instrumental, and some of the monuments, you know, mm-hmm. had some of this monumental architecture, vertical stuff that comes out of those creek beds, you know, is wonderful.
Yeah.
So I, you know, just enlarge my imagination and sense of the power of place, but nothing strikingly here's this one moment or this one site.
Mm.
Not in that one, that was to come later, but not that one.
Right.
Other than things like Monument Creek, and there's a monument, you know, and yes.
The monument in Monument Creek.
Yeah, there was something. You got the idea of these isolated pillars,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
that are in there, which are definitely a go-to kind of thing.
Amazing geology.
Yeah.
So back to the rim then, and... Back to Diamond's.
Yeah, back to yes.
It laboratory.
Was, that was back to Diamond's laboratory, and we. Yes, and then what happened after that was that it was the beginning of the new Dick Hingson here, because I was beginning to break out of the. Membrane physiologist and microanatomist business is a person.
Okay.
I was getting larger and needed more, and getting much more politicized.
Hmm.
I had already become somewhat yes, the politicization had begun strongly at Harvard, I mean, all the business of the Vietnam War coming to a head in the Harvard, final Harvard anatomy days had strongly politicized me, and I was getting to see how history had been suppressed and how it got revealed, and how the American people were deceived by their political system, and so. I had the unexpected thing happen after we got back from the canyon was that a strong early friend from the Harvard graduate days, especially the first year in that dorm in the Cambridge side, turned out he was out in California in Santa Barbara and running he had entered the a Democratic and then general election. He won the primary against Charles Teague, Teague, who was one of those entrenched Republicans in Southern California in Santa Barbara and Ventura counties. And Gary had he had to organize a primary campaign there, and he needed he wondered if I would help him by, you know, with canvassing and other kinds of related grassroots canvassing and organization that had to do with the LA County part of that district.
What was Gary's last name?
Hart. H-A-R-T. H-A-R-T.
This is the Gary Hart that's going to run for president eventually?
No, it's a different Gary Hart. There was another one, but this is a different Gary Hart.
Okay.
And Gary was all into this grassroots. He learned that at Harvard. He knew all about that. That was his style. He's a school teacher, but became very, very liberal, very effective with the very personable, and very good role model for me. And so he wondered if I would organize the LA County part of the 13th. I think it was the 13th congressional district. I think that number is right, but anyway, it was the part of LA that's scenic, actually. It included the Santa Monica Mountains National Recreation Area, down to Woodland Hills and Agoura Hills. So working that part of the district for me was as exotic a way to get out of LA. I had a car, and I found myself fascinated with that. And I realized in doing that that maybe I was not that long for the membrane physiology world. I mean, this was, I was more interested in what was going on with being able to roam around the country and that geography and work on that campaign. So this was the beginning, clearly, of a campaigns are exciting. I mean, they've got drama that I didn't have in the lab with those membranes. Gallbladder, that drama was Jared's when going through the membrane data I was collecting, but I didn't. So I wound up getting all sucked into the both of those campaigns in the spring, and then again in the fall when he lost to Charles Teague eventually. But by this point I was getting kind of stranded in terms of feeling like I was in a dead end on this membrane physiology stuff with Diamond. It wasn't working out. I mean, I could get the data like a lab technician for him, and you know, you're not paid that much as a postdoc, so it's not. But I decided that I had gotten into a tunnel and I had to break out of it. And so I completed the postdoc experience. Okay. The university accepted the fact that I was going to make a transition. Okay. I even got to make one final lecture at UC Berkeley on the work I had done at Harvard. A nice lecture too, it was a good lecture, well received. And I was going to take a chance and leave the field.
Okay.
And so then I was on my own after June of 1971. Now, what happened, I guess you're probably wondering where did I go, and where I went was onto a bunch of summer backpacks because I had the car.
Okay.
And so then this opens up some pretty good car camping in the West. And I'm pretty sure in that car camping, I did do the first of two backpacking trips through the Havasu Reservation, Havasu Canyon.
So down to the falls there?
Yeah, I went all the way to the river.
Okay.
And that was, that first trip was by myself in a lovely set of September days. I had the whole thing to myself.
Wow.
Amazing, amazing peace and tranquility, loveliness, and heck, yeah, I had to climb up one. There's one cliff in there you got to get over. That was tricky. I did it.
The little and chains connected there are
some
the
kind of, I think there were some kind of
travertine passageways.
Well, there's one, you got to get up out of that lovely valley up over one particular slope, and that's a little scary by yourself. You have to be careful, very careful. But I went all the way down the river and back, and that was a great individual backpacking success.
Nice.
John Muir style, you know. And so that was, now there was to be another one 10 years later, but I shouldn't maybe jump ahead except to benchmark it. But this was also setting up the fact that maybe I wanted to go on a Sierra Club Grand Canyon rafting trip. because that was set, I had learned about it, and that was set for the last week of September of 1971, a 10-day trip. And so I got onto that trip and ran the whole thing from Lee's Ferry down to Temple Bar. That, of course, had its own revelation. I suppose I should say something about the most memorable or two episodes of that,
Oh,
or
absolutely. I have a lot of questions for you about that. So, yeah, you bet.
Well, you know, it was a pretty well, you had to pay a couple $1,000s for that trip. You know, it wasn't cheap. You know, you had a maybe 20, 30 people. It was pretty well, I thought they, all the boatmen knew what they were doing, and they had all the different kinds of supplies, including porta potties and other things that you could be reasonably comfortable with. A lot of single individuals, as I remember on that trip, kind of brainy ones, some of them, you know. The one big moment does stand out because we had a crash. You know, where they lost control of the boat and it slammed into the south side of the Granite Gorge, appropriately enough, that Sockdolager Rapid. The Sockdolager Rapid really threw the boatman, and that punctured the pontoon on which I'd been sitting on the pontoon towards the back of, or half partway back, but right in the front it was punctured. And they had to spend some hours repairing the boat at Sockdolager Rapid. And so the other place that, of course, I learned all that geography down there, but the other place that struck me and had meaning for the much of the rest of many years was the long triumphant trip up Conquistador Isle, which is that long, peaceful, straight stretch south to north, majestic kind of very majestic parade up that. And that really stuck in my mind. Of course, I got to see Havasu Creek again, where I had been. You know, that was a major thing. But of course, you know, I don't remember having a river book, but I had the rough map of how we were going, and we just wound up. It was very, the weather held very good. It was hot, 100 degrees, almost 95 or something in the days, and there was no rain until 30 minutes after we got out of Temple Bar and all hell broke loose. Storm front coming in from the west, cold storm. We beat it by 30 minutes. So I re you remember things like
Do
that.
you remember the name of the company? And this was a motor boat, I'm assuming.
Yes, but I'd have to rethink about that or go into
Okay.
a record. I don't remember the name of the outfitter
And do you
all across
remember
that.
the name of the guides at all?
No, I don't. There are no names that
Okay.
stick in my
Do you
mind.
remember the names of anyone else on the trip?
I'd have to research the not out of my head. I'd have to
Okay.
find a trip list to do that. Nobody. There was no one that. I could have hoped for maybe a little more of a you know a life or a somebody you know that you would have had f further communication with, but it just didn't happen on that
Okay.
trip. You know, some of those people were, you know, they're unique, very unique. But there wasn't anyone like that, so I didn't remember. There wasn't anything to carry away like that.
Okay. What happened at Sockdolager? How did you end up having a tangle with the wall there?
Somehow the boatman had lost control in the rapid. I mean, I guess that's possible. And that was not planned.
Okay.
They had lost control, and the boat slammed into it. You could, I mean, I was on the forward end of the boat, not right the place it was going to impact. That was a dramatic moment, you know. And that I was, yes, you would have to say that was a boatman's mistake, probably. But there were no injuries from it, fortunately. So
Okay.
you just had the adventure of the power, you know.
Yeah. So
and there were some hikes. Of course, I remember the hikes. We got to hike up in those side canyons, you know. I mean, I can't remember. We had a book, you know, with the miles and all of this. And
yeah.
But it's a standard trip. And, you know, I oh, we must have, you know, certainly Deer Creek Falls, you know, and there was a Guano Canyon. I remember vaguely, just names, free association, but I haven't studied it lately. You know, they were just all very exotic kinds of places.
Okay.
But we knew where we were each time, what river, mile, and so on. But I beyond that, I don't remember. There were no accidents, no interpersonal conflicts of the sort that do arise sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have that.
Okay.
And it was just a successful, barely escaping the storm.
Yeah.
At the end.
Do you remember, this is getting some detail you may not remember, with since the dam was in place upstream, the water would have been going up and down quite a bit every day. Do you remember being aware of that at all? Or, you know, that would have been the boatman's problem, but not necessarily aware.
Not aware at my particular level,
not
much. I mean, I had nothing to compare with from it, you know. I mean, I remember that, of course, the water was different than when I first hiked through there. I think that it was taking silt out, and so we hadn't had rain, so I'm assuming it was colder.
Okay.
You know.
Uh-huh. Yep.
That's right.
Yep.
I can add to what I've said so far is that the way you would get back was supposed to be a flight over the Grand Canyon, or over part of it anyway, because they would have taken us back to the landing strip near Lee's Ferry.
Okay.
And that was one of my big disappointments, because of the weather, they had to reroute that. They could not go over the canyon. They had to take us way north somewhere, over much closer to Kanab, and didn't get to see what, you know, otherwise I would have seen.
Yeah.
I remember the disappointment of it. But you take your chances.
Mm-hmm.
At least that didn't happen on the river.
Yeah, yeah. Do you remember, was the river clear or was it red?
Oh, yeah, no, I'd have to go into pictures probably, which
okay.
I haven't got. But so there's not a very good memory of, you know, of that. I have seen it blue-green and all these things, but I cannot remember the color right
and then
now.
The last day would have been a long day motoring across the reservoir from the end of the Grand Wash Cliffs past Pierce Ferry all the way to Temple Bar. That's a long way down Greg Basin. It's just a long day sitting on the boats. And
it is true that there was, and yes, you knew your environment had definitely changed once you got past the Grand Wash Cliffs. That is correct. Seemed to me we got out at midday, whatever had happened there.
Mm-hmm.
We got out at, because that storm broke, and there was supposed to be the airplane ride soon after, so that storm broke in late morning, which is when they break. I mean, you know, often, I mean, it's when the front came through. And that's all I remember about that.
Okay.
50 years of just memory. If I research photos, I may, of course, it may trigger some more things.
Yeah. So, did you do any more hiking the next year? How does your line of progress then
with
go
the canyon
forward with
after,
the canyon?
After that, let's see, I would say, there wasn't much more until 1978, right after the 1978 general election.
So jump us from 1970 here, from September of 1971.
Right. Where was I?
To 1978. Can you name a couple of important things that happened during that time?
You mean just in my other life?
Yeah,
you
in general.
The other things that were driving my geography in life and so on were that Right after the rafting trip through the Grand Canyon, I had an invitation to, or the possibility. I arranged it with a friend who'd been very close to me in Johns Hopkins Medical School, named Ray Adelman, RayAdelman, and he was on some kind of residency in San Francisco. And he offered me a place to stay in actually a very large closet in his apartment in San Francisco. And so I went up there and took advantage of that. Now we have to get into personal motivations about why San Francisco, what you would do in San Francisco. And this will figure down the road with the Sierra Club too, because but it's starting there because it's a part of my personal liberation. I needed to find out about the gay movement that was breaking out for my own sense of inner salvation, because that's what I was. All this suppressed, all this held back, all this breaking loose with the social revolution that started with the Stonewall riots in New York City in 1960, June of 69. So San Francisco was alive with all of that. When I, by the time I got up there, and I knew I liked politics, I knew I had the skills that I developed with Gary Hart, and so those skills were transferable. Into things that were, in people, but I needed to connect with all that history up there in San Francisco being the core of all of that. And also on a personal level. And so there was just tremendous experiences of personal liberation that had to do with rap groups, had to do with individuals and people you met and all this, and you learned everything in the world that had been suppressed. And that was a major, major thing for me. And I carried all that through the fall of 1971 and into early 72 with all these connections made there. But I had to I could only stay with Ray so long, who was supportive of that. A Jewish boy who he was supportive of all that. Straight, not a gay one, but he was supportive. And then I got my own apartment with some roommates for a few weeks, and then came another opportunity in 70, early 72, to move to Santa Barbara because Gary Hart, having lost to Charles Teague, now was involved with trying to run for the state assembly. And I happened to call him up at just the right moment in March and see what was happening and any way I could connect. Oh boy, did he need me right there
Oh,
to
good.
help organize. It was lucky, a lucky strike in Santa Barbara yet. And so he invited me to come down, help him run his primary run for the state assembly. And again, it's all the grassroots canvassing. It means the geography. You're working precinct by precinct by precinct. You're plugging people in. I stayed with a supporter there in beautiful canyon behind Santa Barbara. Lovely house, lovely views, one of the loveliest cities in America. And so it was another stroke of luck, I thought. And so we had a successful, he won his primary. And then, of course, that means you did it all over again for the summer and kept going, organizing Santa Barbara, organizing all the liberals and the social activists. People wanted change. So we ran through that and had the great disappointment of his loss on election day by 600 votes out of 120,000. Very depressing night. And I wound up supervising the recount, and being the spokesperson for the campaign during the recount, which went on in the great courthouse of Santa Barbara, county courthouse. There was a medieval castle during the Thanksgiving week in Santa Barbara, but it confirmed that he had lost. So I made the final statement to the press about that. He was away by then. Mm. But now, what to do?
Right.
Well, I was connected to Santa Barbara, so I stayed in Santa Barbara.
Huh. Okay.
And I was in Santa Barbara then from the fall of, the fall of, 72. I think maybe in the summer of 72, I might have gotten very cheap. It was very cheap lodging in Isla Vista, which is well-known hippie hangout and all that. And so I was exposed to all that in the, starting with the summer of 72. Yeah, that's right. It was so cheap that the campaign was willing to pay for that.
Oh.
In the summer of 72.
Okay.
So now I was oriented to UC Santa Barbara. Mm. And there's where I wound up living on unemployment insurance. I had that. But I got into back into UCSB, into a master's program in public and social affairs.
Huh.
So I did, I had two-year thing there, which was actually going to reconnect to the Bay Area when it came time for the field work part of it.
Okay.
That would get me back up into, you know, Palo Alto and the gay movement again. Mm. Well, it was going on in both cities. I mean, this was pretty hot in California.
Was this was this a thesis master?
Yeah, master's thesis.
Okay. What was your thesis on?
The thesis was on it was a field survey, an opinion survey among mental health professionals about it throughout the Palo Alto, that county, Santa Clara County, about all kinds of attitudes concerning the gay population, how to help them, what to do.
Huh.
And so it was a very fertile time. I mean, one has to remember that the big referendum within the American Psychological Association, which took it off the sick list, only came about in 1973.
Okay.
So I was there on the cusp of that. Also, a huge fight broke out within Palo Alto and the school board over a gay non-discrimination policy, a very dramatic fight that the gays won 3-2.
How were you managing your finances at the time?
It was close, but unemployment insurance had somehow worked here. I mean, there was pretty liberal unemployment savings. I mean, there was pretty liberal unemployment insurance rules at the time.
Okay.
That although I had a close calls with them too, but I mean, I
did you work as a teaching assistant?
There was something
UC
like
San
that.
Bernardo
well, and then when I when I finished that MA, I came back to Santa Barbara, and then I got a job doing a social for the student association, paid job doing a survey.
Okay.
I mean, it was a very successful survey, you know, on the use of the recreation fees.
Huh.
I had a great job so that kept me right there on the campus. And I got another job at a place called Lawrence University in Isla Vista, which is a startup private school for people in education.
Huh.
Whether it was the right choice or not, I don't know, but it got me money.
Mm-hmm.
And it got me right down from where I lived in Isla Vista and all that was going on there. So it stabilized me in Santa Barbara while I continued to work all that.
Okay.
Issues. Mm. So it was social activism, but it was both paid and unpaid. I mean, you know, social now is a whole different thing than anatomy, histology. It wasn't that anymore. It was just getting by and getting into all the loveliness of Santa Barbara, you know, with every kind of hike and outdoor and things. So that went on. And
did you maintain your relationship with the Sierra Club during that time? Were you still a member?
No, I was a member, but it was just sort of incidental on the side. I wasn't really doing that much with Sierra Club at that point, although I was seeing the people.
Uh-huh.
I knew who they were, and that's all I could say about it. It came later, the re-entry into Sierra Club, but it wasn't quite to be yet. And then I'm done with Santa Barbara suddenly and unexpectedly in the spring of 1977, because one of the ladies that I was so impressed with me during the Gary Hart campaign knew about me and recommended me for a job in LA. Surprise out of the blue, which pulled me to LA. So I got pulled out of Santa Barbara in along about June of 1977.
Okay.
And now I'm winding up in Hollywood.
What was the work? What was the work that brought you there?
The work, well, the work was that she, this Jewish lady who had helped me organize Gary Hart, had recommended me. She was wired to some other people. And I wound, they needed pretty badly a director for the Gay Community Services Center in Los Angeles, in Hollywood. And would I do that? And of course, there was salary with that. There was, and I wound up with a place to stay in the Hollywood Hills too, with that, with low rent and a view house. 2 years in Southern, in LA, in Hollywood.
Is that working for the city?
The work was for the Community Services Center. In other words, this was private money.
Oh, okay.
And I was the second director or third of the Gay and the Gay Community Services Center in LA.
Okay.
And just as an aside here, it's just the irony of the timing here. In 2 weeks, I will be recognized as one of their chain of executive directors over the past 50 years in LA in the Greek Theater at a gala, 50th anniversary event. So it's a quite a circle closing in 2 weeks, and they're bringing me back, putting me up a hotel.
So, great.
So, but that was the basis for being in LA for the 2 years.
Okay.
This is going to have meeting though with the Sierra Club down the road.
That brings you to 1978 too.
77 to 79.
Okay.
The thing that's probably as singular as anything there was that I was therefore the one that welcomed Mayor Tom Bradley, the first black mayor of LA, to the center when he did his first visit there. And there's a photograph of me, which I have, it's online. It'll be shown at the event in the program.
Cool.
And that was just a big event, you know. So I went through this covered the period through in California, the huge events. I mean, this is one battle royal, you know. The slaying of Harvey Milk and Mayor Moscone, the assassinations. And then the Briggs Initiative, which was to forbid any hiring of gay teachers in the whole state. I mean, this was part of that 2 years.
Okay.
That initiative was won, however, by the gay community, and that was major victory for civil rights. And so I stayed on for another few months after that, and then my time was up at the center and I was on my own again. So that's kind of like the way that was.
I gotta ask you, we're getting way off topic here.
I know, but it fills in the gap.
What were your parents supportive of this? Because they had this vision of firstborn, our son's going to be a doctor. And you got a PhD.
It's all that. That's correct. Yes,
you
that's
got
right.
a postdoc, and you got another master's degree.
That's right. That's correct. That's all correct. You've raised the right question. And the answer during this changed later, but during the 70s, I actually wrote down notes from, there was one just terribly frustrated long-distance call because they'd found out about what I was doing. And there, Ocilla, Georgia, heart of the Deep South.
Okay.
And my father coming out of the Baptist tradition. So you can imagine that all of this, well, yes, there were charges of defaming the family, this stuff.
Yeah. Did they eventually reconcile with you?
Oh, yes, they did reconcile because my father, especially my father, there's a very dramatic final conversation with my father And I don't know whether you want that in the history or not, but I'm willing to talk at the right time about it. But it didn't come until when I was working on the overflights in the mid-90s for the Sierra Club. And there was a very dramatic reversal by my father at that point.
It's funny because, I'm curious to know why it took him so long. Somebody who was a world traveler, who clearly saw a lot of things around the world and yet was still in that Southern mindset. And so we're kind of off in the,
well,
in the weeds
you
here.
You guide it the way you feel. I'm willing to answer the question briefly.
No, it's just...
It's an interesting point.
It's not a question, it's an observation. It seems like somebody who was not just from the South, stuck in the South, somebody who traveled the world.
And was a scientist as well. I mean, he was a research scientist who was well published on, on epidural anesthesia and all the things that went with that, because he was an inventor and so on. And yes, there was a very poignant final conversation where he's hardly able to talk at this point, but he only could talk for maybe 2 minutes at a time, but he had this little thing he must have rehearsed, but he got it out that he finally had to decide that in the end he was a scientist, not a religionist. And so he was close to animals. He understood about animals and animal behavior. And so he made it very clear to me at the end that he understood that wildlife was not all one thing. He had figured that out.
Okay.
And pointed it out to me, actually, from a wheelchair to geese. Males. Both males. He's pointing it out. So you had that was a complete reversal. The mother was too reticent to talk about it. Well, she was harder. That doesn't mean that she wasn't moving some philosophy. I mean, she, but I'm just saying before they died, clearly we were not in the place we were in when I first came out in 1960 in Cleveland. It was very, this was different, especially the father. So yes, that's the answer to the question.
Yeah, it took
a long that
time.
Long though.
Mm.
Yeah. Change is hard.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Not just on that.
Cool.
Yeah.
Thank you. So 1978, does that get you back to Grand Canyon again?
Yeah, it does, because and there's one of the dramatic reconnection, which ought to be just noted, which was right after the Briggs Initiative. I had already scheduled a trip for Veterans Day to hike down to the bottom and back. And it started in warm weather, went down to Phantom Ranch. I must have stayed there that night, and came out into a snowstorm that ended in sunset glory on the new fallen snow. Utter triumph.
Wow.
In the triumph of having just won the Briggs Initiative in California.
Nice.
I mean, that's a moment. That's one of those transcendent. That's transcendence. It does turn out sometimes for the better.
Yeah.
So there, that was a very memorable hike because I'd never seen it snow like that and then clear at the end. And you know how the sunsets can be in the last half hour on a newly snow-covered trail. That was glorious. I've got pictures of that. It's glorious, So I did have that reconnection right at that triumphant psychological moment. And then came back to finish I came back to the center, but I was not the person to stay in that job either. They needed another kind of personality. Nothing that I did wrong, but they needed another kind of personality than the anatomist and the scientist. And this, they needed somebody who connected better to the average Joe that's going to be there. I had stabilized them. So they let me go, but the very day after they let me go, I had another transcendent natural world experience that softened it, and that was the total eclipse of the sun over Western Oregon that I got to see, and the whole dramatic story about that. Another triumph. Two minutes of glory right after but paired with a difficult moment, but it was a great salve. Like it didn't matter.
Nice.
Didn't matter.
Yeah.
So because of the glory.
Yeah.
And the sun only came out during the, you could only see it about in the 10 minutes before it clouded over.
Oh, really?
And then it broke free 10 minutes before the a total eclipse out over the Deschutes in Northern Oregon, and then closed up again for the rest of the day.
Oh, wow.
But we saw it.
Nice.
It wasn't supposed to be seen from there, but we saw it from a hilltop.
Nice.
So it was a great moment with nature, and that's important because this is, you know, where we're coming back to is my connection to these kinds of transcendences of light and shadow and glory that are the Grand Canyon.
Mm.
So it goes in that stream of consciousness.
Okay.
Yeah. So then you're out of there, and another exiting the center in LA. This is just so you see the chronology.
Yeah,
June 79.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but there were trips to the California desert starting up. I was beginning
to
discover that. Well, after all, the Grand Canyon has got that desert. It's a great desert park, really. And I was getting involved with the California desert for the first time.
So this is the Mojave?
The places that they're going to be made in all these national parks, Mojave Preserve area, the Joshua Tree, Death Valley, there's a lot of stuff you could do from LA, and I was doing it during the spring of 79.
Okay.
So this is reconnecting me back to desert, silence, desert, parks, and beginning to elevate that.
Okay.
And so you've got that going on in 79, and then I'm finished with the center there, and then comes a trip to Europe, but I will say on Grand Canyon, it did feature a July 4th window table at the North Rim Lodge. First time I'd been back there in 14 years.
Oh my gosh.
With a hitchhiker that I'd picked up. An interesting young man who actually shared a cabin and a window table at the North Rim Lodge on the night of July 4th. So we had that, and I'm trying to keep it to Canyon and not
That was 1979?
That's 79.
Was there anyone there that you recognized from your...
No, not at Grand Canyon Lodge. No,
okay.
There was nobody there then. It was completely turned over, and the management was different now. So I just remember the window table and sleeping in a cabin. Like that was just a great short but important reunion there. And then followed the 3-month trip to Europe, with a backpack. It was backpacking. I mean, that's how I got around, with a backpack.
Okay.
On a Eurail pass.
Ah.
And then coming back to the U.S. To end up with a family in the end of the 70s, which was then in Pittsburgh. And then Then a few weeks paid work at the beginning of 1980 with family members in South Carolina picking apples, who had a, you know, that's how they, one of the things they did, my sister and her husband, and the New Orleans Mardi Gras, and then I returned to California to Santa Barbara. So you had to figure out what next, and I went back to Santa Barbara. So Santa Barbara riveted me once again for a few years, and all kind of good things happened there that would eventually would return to the canyon, but I went through more campaign organizing for a UCSB professor of history who ran for Congress in 1982, made me his campaign manager by July.
Did he win?
Yeah.
Did he win?
Pardon me?
Did he win?
Lost.
Ah.
Tough politics there.
Yeah.
This is Reagan now.
Okay.
Reagan's in.
Ah.
Bad times. They were bad times for Grand Canyon, too. It was bad news. James Watt and a succession of interior secretaries beginning under Reagan. They were wise use people. So it was bad news, but I was doing other things there that were still important for my self-development and the movement. And I mean, that's how, that was the motivation, mostly the gay movement still, not Sierra Club yet. I mean, there was CalPERG, which was somewhat interested, public interest research group, California public, this door-to-door canvassing, very successful, very supportive friend running that. It would brought me some money. And then came in 1984, another sudden call to LA, out of the blue, just like the thing that had happened with the center in 75 or 77. It was a sudden call to work for the ACLU as the assistant to the executive director of the Southern California ACLU. So that's going to pull me back into LA, and I'm going to be there for 16 years.
Okay. Working for the ACLU?
The first part of it from 84 to the end of the 80s, I'm the assistant to the executive director of the ACLU of Southern California. But the only thing I can say about Canyon in there is that halfway through that period is the Grand Canyon air crash, first of all, which was in 1986 off Point Sublime, followed by Reagan signing the Overflights Act on August 18th of 1987.
And you had yet to start working on overflights. These are just...
Yeah, well, that's right. Although my first letter on the subject, I found out that they... I was interested enough to look at the Federal Register or something like that in that period, because I knew of the airplane crash. And then that they were going to do something, I think it was right after 87. And I found out that my first letter on overflights to Congress was somewhere in 88, I think, regarding a Federal Register notice by the FAA. And they had published an inaccurate map of the new SFAR they were creating, with the flight line shown on the map as being right over the top of Point Sublime. Right over the top, and it was inaccurate.
And you spotted that?
I spotted it. And I wrote a letter, a long letter to the, I think I wrote a letter on that one to Congress, and Congress found out about it, and it expressed displeasure to the FAA about that notice. FAA didn't have a clue what these points meant.
Oh, interesting.
Not a clue.
Okay.
Point Sublime, though, and I've understood this, I don't know what I understood then, I understood later, they had to have this Dragon Carter because that's where Elling Halverson had found these Indian ruins back behind Point Sublime. And so you're leading up to a showdown between the Sierra Club and the Earth First and other, and NPCA and other environmental activists that I found out later about, but it was at Point Sublime in the late 80s. There was a demonstration out there. So yes, this matters, but my letter complained about the whole thing. I mean, I was opposed to all of it. And I just simply objected, you know. And I get one more backpack in those years, which was in the late 80s, some around 1989 maybe. I get get set up a 10-day, maybe it was 87, 90, I'll get the date, but it was a 10-day Grand Canyon backpack. So I had one more really solid Grand Canyon backpack in the late 80s, which involved Hermit and Butcher trails down to Butcher Rapids, camping two nights at Butcher Rapids, and then coming back up out of the Butcher Trail across the Tonneau past Yuma Point and out at Hermit Trail.
Okay.
So I had a 10-day Grand Canyon backpack in there, and I was exposed to the overflights ramping up over Hermit and Butcher.
Okay.
Also, there was annoyance about that in the late 1980s.
Maybe, Dick, I'm going to jump in here, thinking that we've been Yik Yak in about an hour and 10 minutes.
No, that's the right place. That's fine.
Maybe this is a good place to wrap up part 5.
Right.
And we can pick up part 6 with more details of this backpack.
Okay, that would be good, because there were some things that went on there. That would be good. I will happily talk about the backpack. And then...
So as we wrap this part 5 interview up, is there anything else in this section that you want to bring in?
Well, I would just say, as a little side note, I got as a result of something that partly as a result of a lucky event under the ACLU, I got a return to Australia for a month for Halley's Comet, Cape Tribulation, and the Barrier Reef. I'll just put that in as an important side trip. You know, I have to say I got back there. But that doesn't have to do with, keeping this fairly close to the Grand Canyon and environmental thing. I don't think I would say much more about that stretch.
Were you able, I'm just going to ask you though about Australia, were you able to connect up with people that you knew when you were there in that summer?
Yes, the interesting thing was that I had a dinner in Melbourne with the professor's children, a reunion dinner. Wonderful.
Nice.
You know, you can't do better than that, to have found them and had a dinner with them. And he was a city planner in Melbourne by that time, the son.
Uh-huh.
I think Dr. Milton, I do not believe I saw Dr. Milton. He had died by that time. Mm. I've outlived him by quite some time. But the son, John Milton, yes, and his wife. And so,
nice.
I did see, though, my first couple of Australian national parks, though, at Cape Tribulation, and the Warrumbungles, which was to be tied with the comet, Halley's Comet, and that's right beneath the Siding Springs Observatory. So this is getting to my cosmics. This is, you know, the canyon. I'm a cosmic, astronomy oriented, you know, person, and this is perfect. You get Halley's Comet over the Warrumbungles National Park, you know, in the silence of that, with a good friend, an Australian friend. We had this trip out there. We had that. So those were just major benchmarks for my return to Australia. And that's
okay.
All I need to say, because I wasn't doing Grand Canyon then, but that happened.
All right, well, that sounds like a good period there.
Yeah.
On what it will be the conclusion of part 5, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Dick Hingson. Today is September 5th, 2019. My name is Tom Martin, and Dick, thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.